White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Tonight is January 24th already, 2013, and it is our 31st episode. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and...
I'm Hadding Scott.
Well, I guess we're going to have a celebration when we reach our 50th episode, eh, Hadding?
Suppose.
And we still won't be done, but at least that will be almost, that will be like probably close to a year. To give a little introduction to tonight's program, tonight's chapter, which is, chapter 20, I don't know what I said already, chapter 26.
26, yeah.
Yes. It's featuring Bernard Baruch a little bit, not as much, but still, he does feature in it, and, he's called the Jewish dictator of the United States, and during World War One under Woodrow Wilson. So, we've had two episodes featuring Bernard Baruch, and now we're going to have more about him in this third one tonight. And I think that the international Jew writers are making a very important point about Jewry in the United States by using the example of Baruch. And I think they're right to do so because he creates, they're able to show a lot of the way that the Jews operate, how they do things, and how they get away with it by his example. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Well, yeah, I think you were a little broken up there. What I find about it is that it shows that things happen. Some irregularities can occur during wartime. They can't occur at other times because as soon as the war hysteria goes away, people become more critical and they start asking questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I know. All right. We were talking about that in before we came on. I had a little difference of opinion about that you were talking about the temporary quality of Jewish power, and I'm saying it's a permanent quality that's already
there. Yeah, the so-called dictatorship.
And it's not going away unless they get kicked out. Okay, so
The so-called dictatorship of Bernard Baruch was conditional and temporary, but the Jews used the opportunity to pad their pockets in a major way. That's really what I think people should get out of this.
Okay, well, I think they should get out of what they point out, that even though his power diminished when there was no longer a war for him to be, to be the person who ran the war commercially or whatever, they remained in power in so many areas. Plus, they made tons of money for themselves. And, they gained power, which did not go away. He was no longer in that role, and they didn't have that kind of power, every time this happens, they managed to increase their power and their wealth.
The mass media is the most important seat of power in an elective government system.
It's very important, but there's others. There's others. So we're going to find out about that. And we will, we have as I pointed out to you, we have a little bit of a shorter, it's not short, but it's not as long as the previous one. So hopefully we will have time for all this discussion and still finish it. So why don't, would you please get started then?
All right. This is, Shmuley, do you want to read this? This is from Protocol 24.
Okay, I'll do it. This is a quote. The king of Israel must not be influenced by his passions, especially by sensuality. No particular element of his nature must have the upper hand and rule over his mind. Sensuality, more than anything else, upsets mental ability and clearness of vision by deflecting thought to the worst and most bestial side of human nature. The pillar of the universe in the person of the world ruler, sprung from the seed of David, must sacrifice all personal desires for the benefit of the people. That's from Protocol 24, which I think is the last protocol, or close to it. You know, I actually have a comment about that. Do you want to make a comment before I make mine?
Well, this idea that somebody in a position of authority has to put passions aside is just a traditional observation. You can find that with Plato and I'm sure other ancient philosophers. Also, it's not specific to the protocols. Well, they used to say about the Roman emperors that they were always there were always scandals about Roman emperors that they were lecherous and so forth. You know, Tiberius was supposedly had some indecent painting in his villa or something.
Well, I think they are actually describing Adolf Hitler here. Not that they mean to, because this is before Hitler came known. But the person, you know, the kind of person they are describing is the kind of leader that Adolf Hitler was and personified for the Germans and in the interests of Germany. And this is what the Jews want for themselves. They want a leader like that, but they can't find such a person amongst their own so far. They don't make those kind of people. And to me, in my philosophy, that is part of their envy and hatred for the Germans and all Europe. So they think that they can take over Germany and Europe and make that culture and our great men and so on become their own. I really do believe they're trying to steal all of our culture and call it Jewish. And they've done a lot of that already, but there's more to go. And this is one reason why they hate Hitler so much, because he was so great. And this is my own original thought. I wanted people to know that if they come across this later on, they heard it from me.
Okay. Well, you're still assuming that the protocols were actually written by Jews. I don't believe so.
Well, whoever is written from, this is, I think, okay, I'm going on that assumption, yes. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. The scope of Jewish dictatorship in the United States. The common citizen, or excuse me, make a mistake already. The common criticism made against President Wilson that he played a lone hand and would not avail himself of advice can be made only by those who are in ignorance of the Jewish government, which continually advised the president on all matters. While the president is supposed to have been extremely jealous of his authority, this view of him can be maintained only by remaining blind to the immense authority he conferred on the members of the Jewish war government.
And I just want to remind listeners that Wilson was president for two terms, from 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act went into effect, to 1924. So he was in for quite a while after the war was over.
1921.
Oh, I copied that down wrong then. Sorry. Yeah. Is it 1921? Yeah. I had to remember it, and I didn't remember it right. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Republicans occupied the White House.
I thought that seemed like an awful long time. Yeah, okay.
Yes, and so he was reelected in 1916 under the slogan, "He kept us out of war."
Right. Right.
It is true he did not take Congress into his confidence. It is true that he made little of the members of his cabinet. It is also true that he ignored the constitutional place of the United States Senate in the advisory work of making treaties. But it is not true that he acted without advice. It is not true that he depended on his own mind in the conduct of the war and the negotiations at Versailles. Just when Bernard M. Baruch, the Jewish high governor of the United States in war affairs, came to know Mr. Wilson, is yet to be told. But just when he got into and out of the war are matters about which he himself has told us. He got into the war at Plattsburgh 2 years before there was a war. And he got out of the war when the business at Paris was ended.
Okay, well, now here's where I have all my little trivia notes. And I think it's, I think they're worthwhile because, I didn't know about Plattsburgh or what that exactly meant. But it was that, after the outbreak of World War One, you know, in Europe in 1914, Leonard Wood and along with Teddy Roosevelt advocated a summer training school for reserve officers to be held in Plattsburgh, New York. Sometimes it's spelled B-U-R-G, but it was originally spelled B-U-R-G-H or H-G or how do they?
Yeah, that's the post office changed the spellings of some city names, actually.
Ah, okay. And they originally opposed this idea of having training men, you know, in preparation for entering the war was originally opposed by President Woodrow Wilson. And, you know, he may have been serious about keeping America out of war when he ran for his second term. But they certainly were able to persuade him otherwise. Now, something about this Wood, because I'm looking to see if there's any Jews in this whole thing. And they're not obvious, I can tell you. But they're saying here that Bernard Baruch was involved in this, so you never see his name. This Leonard Wood was actually a big deal guy. He was a physician, so often Jews are physicians, and military physicians too. And he served as the chief of staff of the United States Army. That's a pretty big deal. He was military governor of Cuba then and governor general of the Philippines. He was a big military general. He was of English descent. And he was descended from 4 Mayflower passengers, including William White, Francis Cook, Stephen Hopkins, and Richard Warren, all 4 of whom signed the Mayflower Compact. Now, do you think any of those were Jews, Hattie? Outwardly they don't appear to be, but do you know anything about any of those names?
William White. Not that I can tell. You've had more time to go over that than I have.
Yeah, well, I couldn't find anything. Wood developed a friendship with Theodore Roosevelt, who was then Assistant Secretary of the Navy. At the outbreak of the Spanish-American War, Wood, with Roosevelt, organized the first volunteer cavalry, known as the Rough Riders. So, you know, they were close, and they were both they both loved war and battle and so on. And, well, so we know that Roosevelt was Jewish. Franklin Roosevelt is definitely from a Jewish family. In my researches, I did find enough confirmation of that. And they were related.
Yes, I think the Roosevelts had at least some Jewish ancestry.
Mm-hmm. Probably quite a bit.
Yeah, Franklin Roosevelt was asked about that at some point in around 1933, I think, and he didn't deny it. He kind of gave a circular answer.
That's right.
By the way, you mentioned that some people in that group that you suspected might be Jews had ancestors that came over on the Mayflower.
Yeah, they were all descended from Mayflower passengers.
Yeah. A lot of those New Englanders are, I mean, I hate to say this, but a lot of the white people from New England are almost as bad as Jews.
Yeah. They say they blame it on their Calvinism, but it might be their Jewish blood.
It's just that this Puritanism, this puritanical strain, it's what the Catholics called Judaizing Christianity. One of the early heads of the NAACP was not a Jew, actually, but a New Englander from Massachusetts.
Yeah, so they would be pro-war and so on, very patriotic and all that stuff. So that it could be that, you know, but the Jews then could take advantage of that and mix in there. So that's this Wood. So he Wood and Roosevelt were the big names who were opposing staying out of the war, and they wanted to have some training going on. And two others involved were former Secretary of War Elihu Root. E-L-I-H-U, and I found out that he was, didn't seem to be Jewish at all, but turns out I found that he was the founding chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, which was established in 1918 in New York. And he was really pushing for war, you know, for us to enter the war against Germany. And another one, let me just finish this other one, was Henry Stimson, who was Secretary of State from 29 to 33 under Republican Herbert Hoover. And at that time, he articulated the Stimson Doctrine, which announced American opposition to Japanese expansion in Asia. And he was Secretary of War in 40 to 45 under Franklin Roosevelt. He was a leading hawk, it said, calling for war against Germany. And these were the people who in 1915, 16, 1914, and so on, were behind this getting prepared for to enter the war. And they wanted to, they had these, there was two things, the preparedness movement, which was the early one, and then later the Plattsburgh movement was actually, they actually set up training camps that in 1915 and 1916 hosted 40,000 men, largely of elite social classes, talking about those New Englanders, you know. And they were the ones who were really, you know, involved in this. And later, after World War I, they had the citizens' military training camps that trained 4,000 men from 1921 to 1940. So this really sounds like the Jews are involved in this, because once the World War I was over, and then up until we entered World War II, or about ready to, you know, they were pushing this citizens' military training. Now, of course, you don't want citizens' training anything of any kind whatsoever. Yeah. So this is all very suspicious, where obviously, talking about conspiracy, Hanning, there was a conspiracy to get the United States, if you want to call it that, you know, into war, World War One, and as soon as World War One was over, they were working on World War Two.
I think some of these people were seeing dollar signs.
Well, that's always a part of it, you know, of course.
Okay.
All right. Well, that's what I had to say there.
All right.
I learned something for myself.
Okay, we're going back to Bernard Baruch here and his trip to Paris for the peace conference. I came back under George Washington, he testified, which means that he remained at Paris until the last detail was arranged. It is said that Mr. Baruch was normally a Republican until Woodrow Wilson began to loom up as a presidential possibility. The Jews made much of Woodrow Wilson, far too much for his own good. They formed a solid ring around him. There was a time when he communicated to the country through no one but a Jew. The best political writers in the country were sidetracked for 2 years because the president chose the Jewish journalist, David Lawrence, as his unofficial mouthpiece. Lawrence had the run of the White House offices, with frequent access to the president, and for a time he was the high cockalorum of national newspaperdom. But neither that privilege nor the assiduous boasting of the Jewish ring availed to make him a favorite with the American public.
Yeah, the boosting of the Jewish ring. They were boosting these people.
Oh, boosting, yes.
Yeah, and now two things here. I really loved this high cockalorum. You know, and it made me think how this is the way they talked back then. If they wanted to kind of make fun, you know, point out somebody as, you know, in this way, they'd use language like this. Whereas today, we mostly use filthy, dirty language and call people names, you know, if we want to. Don't, right? You know, we don't use, this was kind of a cleaner time. And, you know, I can kind of vaguely, I never heard of cockalorum. But it's, you know, the time when things like
that. Yeah, I looked it up. It means boaster.
Yeah, okay, that's good. I didn't actually look it up, but the cocky type of person, yeah. I think it's funny that they use that. And the other is that Who would think of David Lawrence as a Jew? I wouldn't when I read that name, although I probably should, but, you know, be more suspicious. But I'm sure most of the people at that time didn't know. And this is one of the things that irritates me. I always have to bring up how they hide themselves behind non-Jewish sounding names.
Well, you know, Steve Lawrence, the singer, is a Jew. That seems to be a favorite last name. There was somebody connected with the Clintons. It was L. Larry Lawrence or something.
Yeah, Larry Lawrence.
The Jews like that name.
Well, see, I didn't know Larry Lawrence was Jewish at the time. I wasn't too aware. So, yeah, well, that's good to remember, folks. Lawrence.
Yeah. Okay. American Jewry was democratic until it had secured the last favor that Woodrow Wilson could give. And then it left the Democratic Party as with the indecent haste of rats leaving a sinking ship. Baruch stayed, rather ostentatiously spending his money for motion picture appeals in favor of the League of Nations. But it is entirely probable that he has a genuine interest in the new administration.
Now, were they writing, was there a new, the new Woodrow Wilson administration? Is that
Warren G. Harding.
Okay. All right. Well, this is only written in 1920, and Wilson was president until 21. But I guess that maybe the election
January
had taken.
21, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Right. All right. Harding.
Yeah. For one thing, there may be investigations. It remains to be seen whether the investigations which the Republican majority in the House began to make with regard to war expenditures will be continued. There are those who profess to believe that they will not be continued, the explanation being that such investigation as was made before election was solely for the purpose of securing campaign data or creating a political atmosphere unfavorable to the Democrats. It is sincerely to be hoped that the Republicans will not rest under that imputation, but that they will rigorously pursue the investigations that have been begun. There are two reasons why this should be done. First, that the country may know, with a view to future contingencies, what was put over on the government during the war. Second, that the full sweep of Jewish influence in this country may be exposed. The second reason is not expected to appear very weighty to practical politicians, and that is no matter, for if the first reason is deemed sufficient, and if the investigations are honestly made, then inevitably the Jewish power will be further exposed. It is linked up at every stage of the business. This may have had something to do with the sudden desertion of the Democratic Party by the Jews. They may have swung over in order to have something to say about the pursuit of further investigations. Already the council is being heard. Let bygones be bygones. The people are tired of investigations and don't want any more. Already, attempts are being made to introduce fresher issues to deflect the public mind from war affairs, and the attempts are doubtless Jewish in their origin.
These guys are pretty suspicious, aren't they?
Yeah.
These international Jew writers, they're seen to Jews who are in charge of everything here.
Yeah. That portion of the public who are awake to the Jewish question will do well to observe with care the attitude of the new administration toward completing the investigations. The Jews did not flock to the Republicans for nothing. The country is entitled to know what was done with the fabulous amounts of money spent during the war. The people are entitled to know who were their masters and who were responsible for certain strange situations which were created. Members of the House, senators and other officials should, at the very least, pay particular attention to the directions from which influences against further inquiry come. Now, as to Mr. Bernard Baruch, who for some as yet undefined reason was made head and front of the United States at war, we have his own word on several occasions that he was the most important man in the war. I probably had more power than perhaps any other man did in the war. Doubtless that is true, he told Representative Jeffress. And again, we had the power of priority, which was the greatest power in the war. Exactly. There is no question about that. I assumed that responsibility, sir, and that final determination rested with me. And when Representative
Well, you know, and he says within me. I think that's kind of strange. But he always says, well, we've read this before. Within me.
Yeah, in his it was for him to decide in his own mind what was going to happen.
I believe
that's what he means.
That's right.
And when Representative Jeffress said, what? To that startling statement, Mr. Baruch repeated it. That final determination, as the president said, rested within me.
When we get to the back and forth, you want me to read Baruch?
If you want.
When we get to the question and answer thing?
Right.
Okay.
Representative Graham said to him, in other words, I am right about this, Mr. Baruch, that yours was the guiding mind. And Mr. Baruch replied,
that is partly correct. I think you are entirely correct. Or now, it might be like, I think. He says, that's partly correct. And then he says, I think you are entirely correct. I thought that was kind of strange.
It says, that is partly correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now, in what did Baruch's power consist? Briefly, in this, in the dictatorship of the United States. He once expressed the opinion that the United States could have been managed that way in time of peace. But he explained that it was easier in wartime, was made easy because of the patriotic mood of the people, which I think is a nice euphemism for war hysteria,
mm-hmm.
induced by mass media.
Mm-hmm. With the cooperation of the government and the you know, it's not the media doing it on their own. The government has decided to declare war, so they're certainly by the time he assigned Baruch to this position, we had decided, you know, didn't they, or how did that go? I'm sure Wilson was no longer on the fence about the war
Well, it seems to me that declarations of war or military actions without declaration of war are generally taken in response to a long period of agitation through mass media.
I wouldn't say that. But anyway, I wouldn't say
well,
that.
Well, the mass media.
I mean, it can be, but there's lots of other reasons without the mass media that
there were 15 years of anti-Saddam Hussein propaganda. Before George W. Bush finally...
He wasn't pushed into that by the media. That was the Jews in government. That was Jewish power. That was Jewish bankers. That was the whole Jewish power structure that the media is a part of, I would say, was behind all that. It just took the media. They just had to use the media for quite a while to stir up the people and, you know, get a lot of these lies across and get people believing a lot of lies.
Well, yeah, you have to, if the public is not primed for that kind of thing, it's very hard to do it.
Right, right. Well, that's right.
So ultimately, it's a matter of mass media.
No, I'm saying they work together, hand in hand. So that is one little difference there.
Who do you think decides who gets elected? It's mass media.
Yeah, but it's not the media is just the tool of the people who are deciding that. But it's not the people who are being elected. They're not the ones who decide it. They get chosen.
It is not sufficient, however, to say that Mr. Baruch's rule constituted a dictatorship of the United States. It remains to be shown just how rigid and far-reaching that dictatorship was. The reader may recognize at what point the Jewish rule touched his affairs also. Mr. Baruch, who had the final determination of everything, says that his power extended to the needs of the Army and Navy, the Shipping Board, the Railroad Administration,
touched also the Food and Fuel Administrations, and besides all that, had a vital control of the Allies' purchases, not only in the United States, but also in other countries with reference to certain materials. There were $30 billion spent by the United States government during the war, all of it raised by taxation and bonds. Of this sum, $10 billion was loaned to the Allies and spent here, all of the purchases being vised under Mr. Baruch's authority. I think you multiply that by about a factor of 10 to get the...
to where we are now.
Yeah.
Yeah, if not more. We're into trillions. I don't know, but I guess not spent on war by itself. Yeah, I mean, you know, this was huge at the time. You know, they thought this was really something to give this figure, $30 billion. But it is huge, but we wouldn't think much of it today. It's awful.
As told by himself, his power consisted in the following authorities. 1. Authority over the use of capital in the private business of Americans. This authority was nominally under the Capital Issues Committee, the controlling factor of which was another Jew, Eugene Meyer, Jr. Here is another inexplicable circumstance. Was he the only banker in the United States capable of exercising a dominant influence? Why did it happen that a Jew should be found in this important position too? Is it only accident? Was there no design involved? Well, it was necessary during the war for anyone wishing to use capital in business enterprise to lay all his cards on the table. He was required to reveal his plans, his ground for expecting success, in brief, tell the Jewish rulers and their Jewish representatives all that he would tell in confidence to his banker in negotiating a loan. The organization, which a few Jews perfected, was the most complete business inquisition ever set up in any country. And that the knowledge thus gained should always be sacredly guarded, or always honestly used, would be expecting too much of human nature, not to mention Jewish nature.
Right.
Mr. Baruch gave some instances of this, though they were not the instances that are calculated to throw the most light on the inner workings of the organization. He said,
"The Capital Issues Committee, where Mr. Meyer, well, that's where Mr. Meyer
reigned. Mr. Meyer reigned.
Yes. In the Treasury Department, had a man who sat with the War Industries Board.
Where Mr. Baruch reigned.
And who always came to the War Industries Board to find out whether the individual or the corporation who wanted this money was going to use it for the purpose to win the war. To cite a case that happened in Philadelphia, that city wanted to make extensive public improvements. New York City wanted to spend $8 million dollars for schools, which would take an enormous amount of steel, labor, materials, and transportation. We said, no, that won't help win the war. You can postpone that until later on. We cannot spare the steel on all these various things.
Very well. Does Mr. Baruch know of an enormous theater which a Jewish theatrical owner was permitted to build in an eastern city during the war? Did he ever hear of non-Jews being refused permission to go ahead in a legitimate business which would have helped produce war materials? And that afterward, and almost identically the same plans and in the same locality, a Jewish concern was given permission to do that very thing? This was a terrible power, and far too great to be vested in one man. Certainly it was such a power as should never have been vested in a coterie of Jews. The puzzle of it becomes greater the deeper it is probed. How did it occur? How could it occur that always, At the most critical and delicate points in these matters, there sat a Jew enthroned with autocratic power. Well, could say Mr. Baruch,
I had more power than any man in the war.
He could even have said,
we Jews had more power than you Americans did in the war.
And it would have been true. 2. Authority over all materials. This, of course, included everything. Mr. Baruch was an expert in many of the lines of material involved and had held interests in many of them. What the investigators endeavored to learn was in how many lines he was interested during the war. In lines where Mr. Baruch was not expert, he, of course, had experts in charge. There was Mr. Julius Rosenwald, another Jew, who was in charge of supplies, including clothing, and who had a Mr. Eisenman to represent him. Mr. Eisenman was on the stand for a considerable period with regard to uniforms, the change made in their quality, the price paid to the manufacturers, mostly Jewish, and other interesting questions. The great Guggenheim copper interests, who sold most of the copper used during the war, were represented by a former employee. But undoubtedly Mr. Baruch himself, who was much interested in copper during his business career, was the principal expert in that line. It is impossible to escape the names of Jews all down the line in these most important departments. But for the present, attention is called to the scope of Mr. Baruch's control in the country at large. It is best stated in his own words.
No building costing more than $2,500 could be erected in the United States without approval of the War Industries Board. Nobody could get a barrel of cement without its approval. You could not get a piece of zinc for your kitchen table without the approval of the War Industries Board.
Yeah, so $2,500 would be somewhere over $250,000 today.
Yeah, but that would be not big building. Yeah, I know. That seems a little, it doesn't seem quite right, but anyway, that's what he said.
Yeah.
He might have been lying. How do you know?
3. Authority over industries. He determined where coal might be shipped, where steel might be sold, where industries might be operated, and where not. With the control over capital needed in business, went also control of the materials needed in industry. This control over industry was exercised through the device called priorities, which Mr. Baruch rightly described as the greatest power in the war. He was the most powerful man in the war because he exercised this power. Mr. Baruch said there were 351 or 357 lines of industry under his control in the United States, including practically every raw material in the world. I had the final authority, he said. Whether it was sugars or silk or cannon or coal or cannon, Mr. Baruch ruled its movements. Okay, dialogue here. Mr. Jeffress, for instance, this priority that you had would decide whether citizens would have any commodities for building? Mr. Baruch.
Yes. Yeah, yes. If we had not had that priority committee, the civilians would have had nothing.
Mr. Jeffress. Did they get anything? Mr. Baruch.
They got all there was.
Mr. Jeffress. Did you sit with these priority boards at any time or not, Mr. Baruch?
Sometimes, not very frequently. I was ex officio of every one of the committees and made it my business to go around as far as I could and keep in touch with everything.
Mr. Jeffress. And all these different lines really ultimately centered in you, so far as power was concerned? Mr. Baruch.
Yes, sir, it did. I probably had more power than perhaps any other man did in the war. Doubtless, that is true.
That, however, was not the full extent of Mr. Baruch's control over industry. The heart of industry is power. Mr. Baruch controlled the power of the United States, the dream of the power trust, an evil dream for this country, was realized for the first time under the organization which this single individual forms. He says,
"Not only did we endeavor to control the raw materials, but as well the manufacturing facilities of the country. We established priority uses also for power."
Number 4, authority over the classes of men to be called to military service. Baruch virtually pointed out to the Provost Marshal of the United States, to the classes of men to be taken into the army.
"We had to decide virtually the necessity of such things. We decided that the less essential industries would have to be curbed, and it was from them that manpower would have to be taken for the army."
In this way, he ruled chauffeurs, traveling salesmen, and similar classes into army service, military service. It was, of course, necessary that some such ruling should be made, but why one man? Why always this one man? Number 5, authority over the personnel of labor in this country.
"We decided upon a dilution of men with women labor, which was a thing that had always been fought by the labor unions."
And for good reason. Number 6, and now behold, as complete an illustration of one part of the protocols as ever could be found in any Gentile government. Readers of previous articles will remember the passage. I can read this if you want.
Yeah.
"We will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to the workers, for we will at the same time cause a rise in the prices of necessities."
Mr. Baruch, at one time, was inclined to sidestep the matter of fixing wages. He did not like the expression. But, that the reader may himself decide, we quote the testimony in full. Mr. Jeffress: "Did the War Industry Board fix the price of labor?" Mr. Baruch:
"If you can call it that way, but I would not say so. No, sir."
Mr. Jeffress: "I am trying to get at what you did." Mr. Baruch:
"No, sir, we did not fix the price of wages."
Mr. Jeffress: "What did you do?"
Mr. "Just Baruch: what I told you."
Mr. Jeffress: "Probably I am a little dense, but I did not catch it if you told me." Mr. Baruch:
"When the price fixing committee fixed the price of steel, we will say, they said, this price is agreed upon, and you shall keep wages where they are. And those were the wages that were prevailing at the price we fixed. At the time prices were fixed, at first they were very much higher than the prices that we fixed."
Mr. Jeffress: "When you got the price of any of these low materials, you would fix the price of labor that was to be employed in producing them?" Mr. Baruch:
"To the extent that it should remain at the maximum of what it was when we fixed the price."
Considering the weight of Mr. Baruch's authority and the stipulations he made, this was to all intents and purposes a fixing of the rate of wages. Now, as to the fixing of prices, Mr. Baruch is much more positive. In answer to a question by Mr. Garrett, Mr. Baruch said,
"We fixed the prices in cooperation with the industries, but when we fixed the price, we fixed it for the total production, not alone for the Army and the Navy, but for the Allies and the civilian population."
The minutes of one of the meetings of Mr. Baruch's board show this: "Commissioner Baruch directed that the minutes show that the commission had consumed the entire afternoon in a discussion of price fixing, particularly with respect, with reference to the control of the food supply, grain, cotton, wool, and raw materials generally.
Mr. Graham.
Tell me something else. How much personal attention did you give to the matter of price fixing, Mr. Baruch?
In the beginning, considerable.
At another time, Mr. Baruch said,
there was no law at all in the land to fix prices.
Mr. Jeffress,
we grant that, but you did it,
Mr. Baruch.
Yes, we did it, and we did a great many things in the stress of the times.
Here was one man having supreme dictatorial power at both ends of the common people's affairs. He admits that of the 351 or 357 lines of essential industry which he controlled, he fixed the prices at which the commodities should be sold to the government and to civilians. In fixing the prices, however, he made wage stipulations. The matter of wages came first. It entered into Mr. Baruch's computation of the cost, on which, to a certain extent, he based the price. Then, having decided what the producer was to receive in wages, he decided next what the producer should pay for living. The producer himself may answer the question as to how it all turned out. Wages were high, but not quite so high as living. And the answer to both is in the testimony of Barney Baruch. That is not the whole story by any means. It is inserted here merely to find its place in the list of authorities conferred on Mr. Baruch. How completely Baruch felt himself to be the power is shown by a passage which occurred when he was trying to explain the very large profits made by some concerns with which he did business. Mr. Jeffress. Then the system which you did adopt did not give the Lucan's Steel and Iron Company the amount of profit that the low-producing companies had?
Mr. Baruch.
No, but we took 80% away from the others.
Mr. Jeffress.
The law did that, didn't it?
Mr. Baruch.
Yes, the law did that.
Mr. Graham.
What did you mean by the use of the word we,
Mr. Baruch?
The government did that, excuse me, but I meant we, the Congress.
Mr. Graham.
You meant that the Congress passed a law covering that,
Mr. Baruch?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Graham.
Did you have anything to do with that,
Mr. Baruch?
Not a thing.
Mr. Graham.
Then I would not use the word we if I were you.
Whether Mr. Baruch slipped up there, he best knows. Just as he had power to give the workers wages and take it away again by price fixing, so he had power to allow the raw material corporations to make fabulous profits. And it would not be at all unthinkable that he also had something to do with taking part of it away again. He once said,
we took away 80%.
Then he confessed it was a slip. Of the tongue or of his prudence? Certainly, the profits he allowed were so large that even where the 80% was paid back, where it was paid back, there were all kinds of evasions and frauds, the profits were still enormous. And 73% of the war millionaires of New York, in spite of the 80%, are Jews.
All right, that's the end of that chapter, which was appeared in the Dearborn Independent on 4th December, 1920. Now, Hadding, we have about 10 minutes here. You are the student of economics. So why don't you, can you explain some of this it left me a little bit. I know the price fixing, wage fixing, you know, but all I can get from that, because it's so confusing, and this Baruch was confusing on purpose, is that, you know, naturally they're going to fix wages and prices and supposed to come out even, but somehow it doesn't necessarily, that people are left with the lower standard of living, then, you know, their wages aren't keeping up with the prices. But then again, there's this 80%, and I, you know, he says that they did this, and then they took 80% away from those who they didn't put controls on, or what does that mean anyway?
Well, I don't know. I really didn't sort it out, but I can tell you that for a country at war, it's very often the case that they resort to a regulated economy.
Yeah.
The only problem is when somebody doing the regulation is not trustworthy, or might not be trustworthy, and when that person has cronies, then you get war profiteering.
Well, yeah. Well, we understand that, and you know that happens whenever there's opportunities for a lot of money. You're going to find that. And to put Jews in charge of this is just totally wrong-headed. And who did it? Why? Oh, maybe we can go back to that. Why? They were asking the question, but they didn't answer it, as to why this happened. How did this? Why was this man given all this power? Did it really come just from Woodrow Wilson? Was Woodrow, you know, who? But they didn't answer that I see.
I think it goes back to the fact that Samuel Untermyer had a handle on Wilson because of that illegitimate child and the woman that wanted the $40,000 that Samuel Untermyer took care of for Wilson. And in exchange for that, Wilson had to take certain advisors, I think. That's my speculation.
Now, you know, this Wilson couldn't have been such a scumbag that he would sell out the whole country and all these soldiers and so on for that. But they probably convinced him that they were doing what was in the best interest and they would be good at what they were doing. And, you know, they were the best people around and all that. And he wanted to be convinced, so he was. And then as the story goes, you know, on his deathbed or something, he said, "Oh, my God, I'm horrified. What did he say?
I'm a most unhappy man. I have ruined my country," or something like that.
Yeah,
but I think that's an apocryphal quote. I don't think it's really
No, we can't.
Firmly,
we weren't there. But he may have had that realization. And when he was dying, he may have been truly sorry and realized, you know, what he did. Whereas,
well,
until then, he was, of course, if he was so far gone mentally, I don't know.
If he had his arm twisted through blackmail, then, you know, he could have felt that way. But his mind was also deteriorating.
Yes.
During the second term.
Yeah. Well, so what would be your answer as to how this came about? How did it come about that this Jew and his coterie of Jewish friends took control of the United States war industries, not just the war industries, but everything that could be done and not done and so on financially.
Jews are very good at self-promotion, and they will also promote their fellow Jews. And so it's not hard for a Jewish so-called expert to find a claque of other Jews that will say how wonderful he is. And that person is liable to get chosen for some position of authority just because there are a lot of other Jews rooting for him, and somebody is not paying attention to the ethnicity of all the people that are making all the noise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used
That's pretty, you know, basic. I mean,
yeah.
We don't have any answers except just the you're accusing me of generalizations before the program. Now you're generalizing.
Well, it was a different matter, but
this is just a generalization, and I think we should get more. Obviously they don't have the answers. They didn't give us any. Except to show, to tell, you know, that we should be alert and understand how this happens and not to let it happen. But, you know, every time we learn all these things, you know, this happens again and again, and then it happens again, because there's somehow we don't have the way to counteract it or stop it or recognize
it. The hype that Jews in mass media will lavish upon other Jews is it reaches absurdities. You know, like this fraud Uri Geller with the spoon bending. That guy's only a celebrity because he got a lot of indulgence from Jewish mass media. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's not hard what he does. And when I used to hear Larry King live, every time they were talking about a Jewish celebrity, they would go to the superlatives in praise. You know, like Barbara Streisand, they say that her voice reaches limits that you cannot reproduce on a recording. And, you know, stuff like this. And okay, it's mm-hmm. because she's Jewish. All right, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, and Baruch probably got all kinds of exaggerated praise and probably had a reputation out of, you know, even though they concede here that he was brilliant, he probably wasn't the only brilliant person around.
Yeah. Well, sure. Sure. You know, well, they said that. They said, there's no doubt that these Jews who are given these jobs are competent and they're intelligent and so on. But are only Jews competent and intelligent to do these jobs? Of course not. And the others would have some interest in the good of the country, whereas these Jews don't. So, this is just the same old scam that's going on that we can't seem to get rid of it. But, you know, I was just going to comment on the idea of, I can't find it now, but where they were talking about the exceptions, or that's not the word they used, the people who didn't have to go to war if they were involved in something that was, what was the word they used? Essential industries that are essential work, and that chauffeurs and some other people weren't essential. And so
traveling
they had
salesmen. Fight.
Well, you know, my father was drafted, and he went and had his physical, and he was, you know, approved, and he was just waiting for to get his orders, you know, of being called up. And then they changed. They gave him an exception because they of this same thing. He was essential. He owned a business, and he was essential. The business was essential, and he was essential to the business. And he also had a child, and so they exempted him, and he didn't have to go, which I'm glad of, because he probably wouldn't come back or something. But you know, you never know. I mean, he wasn't anybody important or anything, but within the community, they just, and of course, this was when he was pushing the age limit too. He was at the upper end of the age limit, but, there you are. That was just my little story. Now we have a few seconds, you finish.
I have a male relative that escaped the draft in World War II because he was a bus driver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even that could be essential. That's right. If they don't have anybody to replace him, and they need him. All right. Well, this was very interesting to me. And, you know, I get all worked up when I read these chapters. Next week is going to be very good too. I forget the title of it, but it's not going to be about Baruch, Bernard Baruch, but he shows up. He will show up again. So, we will see you all next week.
Next week is Jewish Copper Kings Reap Rich War Profits.
Yeah, well, there'll be a little bit of Bernard Baruch in there, but not as much. Okay, thanks, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.